Welcome to Footnotes of History, the podcast that sees treasure where others see only barren wasteland. With you as always are myself, Daniel Nesbitt, and our chief surveyor, Tim Philpott.
Thanks, Dan. Today's episode is going to be on Russia and America. The sale of Alaska to the United States of America. Today's episode is footnotesofhistory.com/9. I think most people don't even know that this was a thing. I don't know how much you know about it.
I only briefly kind of realised beforehand that Russia actually owned part of America.
It's quite strange, isn't it? Mm-hmm. While I was researching it, found a couple of mentions that some high-profile Russians had said, "Oh, we got a bad deal, blah blah blah. Oh, we should never have sold it." This kind of thing. This kind of like
just a few hundred years too late.
Exactly. Yeah, 150th anniversary. Well, CNN had like an article on it as well. That sale of 150 years of American
dominance.
Surprisingly, fitting for what we're about to discuss. But would you like to begin?
Yes, I think probably a good place to start is why Russia owned Alaska.
Yeah,
what Russia was doing in North America at that time.
I suppose in some ways you would sort of see it in 19th century terms. Is sort of, they're not geographically, close per se, but they are at least near to Russia.
Yeah, and I think it does make sense.
It's a massive area.
Yeah, but, it makes sense from that perspective, I think. That's basically what happened, is that Russia had got to the edge of Siberia. Yeah. I think Peter the Great decided then, let's see what else is out there kind of thing.
Yeah.
How far can we go? And that's why he sent expeditions across in the 1720s and 40s, roughly.
Yeah.
And then the Russians landed. They, after some rather trying circumstances, which led to a lot of them dying in shipwrecks and explosion, that type of thing, they brought back various pelts of animals and furs, and this obviously caused great excitement in Russia. So then I think they thought, let's continue and keep establishing trading posts and places for people to go and collect these furs and bring them back.
Yes, yeah. I thought it was interesting. Like, it's quite weird to think of, obviously, when you think of the discovery of America, this is obviously the discovery of the other half, other side of America. Mm-hmm. It's quite, I mean, I wonder at the time people realised, I presume they probably did realise that they were connected to the same landmass. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's quite late in the century.
It is. I think also, we should probably also mention the Russians did also extend down from Alaska into Northern California. So they kind of hugged the coast all the way, but they went into Northern California as well and established a trading post at Fort Ross, I think, which they were there until 1841, so quite late on. It was only then that they moved back again.
So they had
a relatively big presence, I think, in terms of sort of actual activity there. I think there was about 500 Russians there at any one time. Big is in terms of what they were getting out of it. In terms of their actual sort of manpower there, it was relatively small. I think they did have a big impact on the area as well, given that when they arrived, the indigenous population dropped by 50% or something.
Really?
Because
they basically just killed them.
They killed them and then drove them out.
This is the classic colonial way. It is. In a way, this is actually a sort of classic. Like, you can apply the sort of template, as it were, to the same situation. And in other ways as well, as we were about to find out. But I would say as well, it's interesting how it's always along the coast. I mean, as you would expect, as a historian, you'd expect this, but maybe a layman would not. It's always all along the coast. Because obviously you can't get very far inland, essentially. There aren't any trains, there aren't any cars, no vehicles. So you have to just either use waterways or remain on the coast.
Yeah.
I suppose there's no point in sort of exploring the interior if you don't think there's anything there as well.
Also, I think, it's difficult to get in, but it's even more difficult to get back out. Whatever you have, you don't have to carry back out, basically on your own back or on the back of any sort of animal you managed to bring with you.
Yeah. So what would you say, what is it that they were looking for?
I think in general it was tradable goods that they could make some sort of profit off. So I do have some sort of quite horrific statistics about what they did to the local animal population as well as the indigenous population.
Like seals.
Exactly. So they were looking, the thing that caused the most sort of excitement was these seal pelts, the sea otter pelts they brought back, because they would be quite valuable.
Oh yeah, sea otter,
And so in 1821, the Russians...
What is a sea otter pelt?
I think I don't know exactly which bits, but I imagine the whole thing.
So
in 1821, the sort of pelts they collected were, this is the Russians and Russian American company.
This is 1821.
1821. Okay. Yeah. 1.3 million foxes of various species. Jesus. There are over 70,000 sea otters, 59 river otters, 34,000 beavers, 30,000 sables, 17,000 wolverines, 14,000 fur seals, along with other numbers of lynx, wolf, sea lion, walrus, and bears.
Absolutely.
So that's just sort of like going in and killing everything inside by the sound of it.
Yeah. I mean, there's an interesting thing here as well, because you said the Russians caught them, but in fact, the Russians obviously.
But they
basically, as far as I can see, they basically enslaved the local population in sort of short chunks. Mm-hmm. Paid them.
Indentured to
them. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. To find them and farm. Yeah, find them and hunt them and get them back. Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically. It was astonishing reasons.
It was.
But it's an interesting. There is an interesting contrast, I think, coming up, which I'm going to allude to now. But basically, they as you said, they hunted it dry, not hunted it dry, but they stripped it essentially of all the.
Where this is.
They almost obliterated the wildlife.
Yeah. Well, they did. It was completely decimated, especially I think the small valuable animals like sea otters. Their numbers just disappeared, and that's I think one of the key reasons why they ran into difficulties, because they had just literally not. Cared about killing everything they could to get it back.
Yeah. Did you in your research come much across who was doing this? As in what arm of the Russian state was doing this? This essentially exploitation of natural resources.
Well, I saw that it was under control of they'd been granted monopoly by the crown.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Russian American.
I don't know specifically who was doing it.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting story, actually. It's quite a sort of, I was quite looking forward to describing this.
Okay.
So basically, they started off, the Russian-American company essentially started off as a sort of syndication. Yeah, they were granted a monopoly by the crown to work in the Alaskan type area. There was sort of a syndication of merchants and seamen and entrepreneurs.
Okay.
But then, and in charge they had, he called himself the Pizarro of Alaska, or Pizarro.
Oh, yeah, I think that's what
he saw.
It's quite sinister.
Yeah. But he was, the sort of like really, he was the sort of chief manager of the company at the time.
We'll try and get a picture of him. He definitely paints an image of what this type of people were like.
Potentially. Although the profits were partially state-owned, he was a businessman, so he was sort of going around and doing all this stuff as the manager in Alaska at the time.
Yeah.
But then over time, the state control of the company sort of increased, and the directors were all civilian directors were all sort of booted out, and it became owned by nobles and the Navy, the Russian Navy instead. You know, it became like law that you had to have a Russian Navy chief manager.
Yeah.
And as soon as they did this, the salaries that were paid to all the managers went through the roof, and all the workers who were being paid, and then all the payments that went out to the hunters, who they obviously conscripted into this work, were reduced massively, but they were expected to do the same job. So they worked them essentially. They essentially absolutely sweated them to the bone, and. Yeah, although we can't say for sure that the civilian version of it would have done the same or not, I feel like the sort of outrageous, almost sort of cavalier exploitation of the situation by the Russian Navy might have led it to be even more extreme in its hunting activities.
Yeah. I did also read that it was a key putting the Navy in charge, basically, because they then also mandated they needed naval command of the ships and that type of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
instead of the merchants and other people have been doing it in the past. Putting that in charge had a massively negative impact. They didn't understand the ins and outs of the sort of fur business.
So it
make sense that they, as we'll see.
Yeah, they didn't, in sort of economic terms, they didn't have the social capital or the contacts, essentially, to sell the furs on to make value of them, essentially, I think, yeah. I think also, a quick fun fact as well. Just this afternoon, I got an email, which was really interesting to me, only in a very nerdy historical kind of way. So they were trying to, during this time, the Russians were trying to trade with Chinese port, Guangzhou, is it called? It was quite a major port at the time, even at the time. And they tried and failed a couple of times. They never quite got trading rights there, so they didn't quite manage to break in there. But the email today was from a company which I ordered something from. and they were based in Gangseo. It was
amazing. It wasn't a sea otter.
No, it wasn't. Although, actually, funny enough, it was a coat. So maybe the...
was it made of?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know.
Is this the Russian Navy just getting their product out?
Yeah, potentially, yeah.
From the 1700s.
Several hundred years later, potentially, yeah. But yeah, so... so that was a thing. Maybe we should talk more... Maybe we should sort of...
should we move into the next bit? Of
yeah, why, the next phase.
Why Russia wanted to sell.
Yeah.
Thing. Right. What went wrong?
Yeah.
So they've got all these, you know, tens of thousands and millions of fur pelts coming back, all sorts of other sort of materials coming back as well. I think they were had to import salt as well for the Russian crown at one point.
I think they were basically sort of... I get the impression that they sort of ran out of their primary good.
Mm.
So they were sort of mucking about with all kinds of other things,
mm-hmm.
Trying to make it come together. But obviously, like I say, as they're all like, you know, they're all naval officers. And all,
yeah.
They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's why they've hunted all these things to extinction.
Yeah,
why they're not established trading rights and that type of thing.
Mm.
But yeah, so I mean, that is a key element of why Russia started wanting to get rid of Alaska, basically, and get rid of the Russian-American companies, because it had become such a big drain.
It was a burden.
Yeah, it wasn't helping. It was a drain economy. They had to take loans out, basically, from the crown to keep solvent.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was being subsidised.
It was quite heavily.
Yeah.
And I think this is probably the sort of spark that lights the fuse, if you will.
Well, I mean, I suppose so. I mean, I would say it's more of a long-term economic trend, isn't it? I mean, but then obviously it blends, as you're probably about to say, mm-hmm. with the other trends that are happening at the time, most notably sort of imperial ambitions from other countries, other powers.
Well, and also quite rightly that, you know, if they had been still profitable, they probably would have wanted to hang on
exactly,
to it a lot
more.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah. But yeah, given... As you noted, one big point, I think, is the Crimean War, which we come back to in a few different episodes now, but it has an impact here too.
Yeah.
Obviously, Russia had fought with Britain and France.
Yeah.
And France
Boston
and, of course, and the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
And the territory had been kind of... It's not really been impacted by the war because the Russians managed to fend off the British and French fleet that attacked them.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it was a huge fleet, it was a few ships, I think. But
yeah.
They basically managed to push them back.
Yeah.
But they were worried about the sort of long-term
effects
of what was going to happen, because in 1858, the British Columbia, which is directly south of Alaska, if you go along the coast, had been made into a crown colony by Britain.
The west coast of Canada.
Made into a crown colony following the discovery of gold.
Yeah.
What was called the Fraser Canyon Gold Rush. And this basically was a mark by the British to say, we're here to stay.
Yeah.
The Russians were getting increasingly nervous that if they didn't do something about it, the British might come and take Alaska and inflict another humiliation on them, essentially.
Yeah.
So from that angle, it was probably preferable to get rid of this dead weight and not use it and then look bad internationally again.
I think you're right. I think it's quite strange when you look at a map, obviously, because we're used to looking at it from a European-British perspective, I suppose. You don't really think of it in the same way that you would as somebody of the time.
Yeah.
Obviously, when you look at the map and you see, British Columbia is right next to it, then you can understand their worry.
Yeah, definitely.
Their concern, basically. And I think there was also a sort of it was quite hard to supply and fortify as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which obviously led to further worries, I suppose, concerns about that. Yeah.
And there was also, I think, also as time went on, as we get later and more towards the actual sale of it, there was the issue of the crown had, as we could in one of our episodes, Tsar Alexander II had emancipated Russian serfs, which cost him a huge amount of money because he basically paid the landowners to let them go.
Yeah.
And then they would obviously pay him back in instalments, but he had to put a lot of money up front, which left quite a bit of a black hole in his funds.
Yeah.
And he was looking for schemes to actually recoup some money quickly.
Yeah.
So I think that played into it as well.
Yeah. Which was actually a really interesting point, actually, because I read conflicting sources on this.
Mm-hmm.
But from one side, obviously, as you say, this was seen as sort of a payment towards the deficit that the Tsar had towards his land, towards abolishing serfdom. But at the same time, from the American side, it was considered a really good deal because it was so cheap.
Yeah.
But I suppose this, and this I think is an element of why this is such an interesting... Another part of why this is quite interesting, because the disparity of what they saw as valuable shows how, by comparison, Russia was so behind economically.
Yeah, well, it reinforces that. Yeah, thing, as we were saying in one of our episodes, how they just failed to industrialize and failed to keep pace with the rest of the world, basically.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think it just shows it even more here that you've got one country that's on the up, basically, in terms of America, which knows the value of things and which has...
Yeah.
expansionist ambitions to actually, in some ways, develop and make things better. Rather, Russia was basically just happy to just kind of like,
well, it was
just take, and when it ran out, it was finished. There's nothing else you could do with it, kind of thing.
It didn't really, I think in a way, they didn't really. I mean, as I was saying earlier, the Russian approach was to try and strip it dry, essentially. Mm. Strip it bare, rather.
It's kind of similar to if you're a farmer, you often leave land fallow so it can recover whilst you farm the other bits of land, and then you rotate to make sure that you don't just destroy your entire farm, basically.
Well, exactly. That's
kind of what the Russians do.
Exactly,
in terms of destroying it, whereas America would come in and look at the complete picture and what else they could do with it first. They went destroying one bit of it.
Yeah, and I think it was quite, also the sort of Americans were very much more like, in order to make these things that they're, essentially, you know, somebody would own, you know, basically private property.
Yeah.
American, somebody who would own a section of whatever it was, you know, the seal fisheries and all this kind of stuff, wouldn't want to completely strip it bare, because then they wouldn't have nothing else for the next year, that kind of thing. So it kind of carries on and kind of expands almost.
So we've got this picture of Russia being quite impoverished in many ways by both war and other ongoing costs.
Political costs.
They're concerned about Britain forcibly gaining hold of the territory and then dominating part of the Pacific. This would be quite worrying for them, because they're already competing along in sort of Afghanistan, that type of area. So they probably don't want another front opening up there. And also, you're looking at a company that has basically become a liability. So there's no incentive to keep hold of it. So I think they're the key Russian.
Yeah. I think you're
getting rid.
Absolutely. The Russian American game is like a disaster.
It's a basket.
By the end of it, I mean, it's just like, okay. They essentially just carried on paying these ludicrous salaries to their bosses, their managers, without actually doing any work.
Yeah.
By the end of it. But there was also an added thing. They had to deal with constant uprisings by the native people as well. Which I think at some point they actually sort of shelled some of their villages. The sale then.
Yeah, we knew you've got the
especially.
Yeah, sorry, go on.
I was going to say the sale was sort of mooted at. I mean, America obviously was. What would you say the context
of America? I think for America, you kind of have to look at one man, and that's William H. Seward, who is at that time the Secretary of State. So basically the person in charge of their foreign affairs.
Yeah.
And he's a big, what we call like a big beast now in terms of the cabinet and American politics. He's been a governor. He ran for president against Lincoln, was defeated, but then was brought into Lincoln's sort of team of rivals, as it's been called, and he became Lincoln's very much right-hand man.
Yeah.
He was also a target of the assassination when Lincoln was assassinated
as
part of the wider plot, but that one failed.
Yeah.
And for him, he's looking at America as a kind of a growing power. He's looking to expand it, and he believes very strongly in this manifest destiny that America has to rule the continent.
Well, I think it's really interesting what you said earlier about obviously the Civil War was almost like, the type of politician that William Seward is like, oh my God, we're actually losing part of our country.
So we better bring
it back together. Force it back together.
Existential crisis.
I think the Tsar's brother said at the time, it's like, oh, we should just give it to the Americans, because they obviously want to own all of North America. They had other ambitions. Especially in the British Columbia was, having completed, I suppose, the Civil War, they were like, I think they were sort of looking for a quick win.
Yeah,
essentially, America.
Yeah, I think they also, yeah, I think with, as you just touched on there,
yeah.
with Canada,
and also I think they also had a caretaker president at the time.
Yeah,
I don't know if you noticed that, but yeah, Andrew Johnson.
Yeah,
that's the most ordinary name in the universe. I think
you touched on something quite important there, is that they kind of, I think in many ways, saw Canada as their backyard.
Yeah.
And they had, a lot of politicians at the time had ambitions to basically grab a bit of it.
Yeah.
I think getting Alaska for some of them was quite a good stepping stone, because you then have, you're both on the north and the south.
Yeah.
And almost encircling them in some ways, which is almost like another bit of the jigsaw.
Surrounded North American continent. Yeah, and then obviously flipping the modern world on its head slightly. America and Britain are really not the best of friends at this point.
No, not at all.
I don't think also, that's quite interesting. You never really think of America, USA, obviously, as being a sort of imperial power, but in this sort of period, they are.
They definitely have ambitions. I think it's something we're going to touch on more in future episodes. They definitely have ambitions in Asia as well.
Oh, really?
There's sort of repeated elements, sort of opening up Japan to trade by force.
Yeah.
And I think places like Korea as well, you definitely see American troops appearing and trying to grab a bit of it.
Yeah.
But I think also, it's not just sort of military they're looking to expand. I think Seward as well is looking to Asia as. Sort of almost in the mirror of today, is as an area for increased trade and sort of more economic focus going on there. So he was aiming to also ring America with friendly sort of way stations and ports and also coaling stations, which could help resupply and sort of traders on their way. And already by 1864, so before the actually so went through, he noted that Alaska would be beneficial to us and by no means to Russia if they managed to get it, because obviously they could give them some money, but it'd be beneficial for them to have it. So he was very clearly in favour of getting Alaska.
Yeah. I think in terms of, just thinking back to that, what the Russian officials said just recently, one day. I mean, I don't think there is any, I mean, this is, the deal obviously did work for, I mean, in the context of what we know what happened afterwards, which we'll probably move on to, especially in the discovery of gold and stuff. But, because Russia, I just don't think that Russia had the ability to make it profitable.
No,
like America eventually did.
Mm-hmm. I think it very ties into, as I think we touched on it a bit before, and it ties into our episode on serfdom as well, how far behind they were.
Yeah.
They just weren't at that sort of level of development to be able to fully invest and oversee something like Alaska being brought into, being a profitable enterprise for them, I think.
Yeah.
I think, in many ways it was the best thing they could do was to sell it for as much money as they could.
Yeah, I think it's obviously clear as well the fact that they didn't even hunt seals and that's they didn't trade with Alaska. The local people of Alaska.
Yeah, it was a cash cow.
They essentially conquered them.
Yeah.
And then forced them to do the work for them, which is a classic feudalism.
So yes. Yeah. Yeah. No. That's a very good way of looking at it. Yeah. They're not looking to develop it and make an ongoing thing. They're just looking to reap as much as they can from it now.
Yeah.
And then. The consequences are later than I won't really think
about. Yeah, exactly, yeah. We'll just pass it off to America.
Yeah, basically.
I mean, it seems to be the answer.
And America was very happy to have it, because I think also, going back to Seward and his sort of America's expanding around the globe element, he'd also noticed that...
The first American dream.
Yeah.
American nightmare.
Yeah. He'd also noticed that there were American merchants sort of already active in the Amur River Basin and what's sort of... goes through China and into southern Russia.
Yeah.
So you could see that there was already American links in that area. Yeah. And if it got... Alaska, it could be another way of being into that and giving them more supply and giving them another route to get things across.
Was this like a stepping stone to Hawaii? Well, not really.
I don't know, to be honest. Okay. I don't know. I think maybe Hawaii was part of that same plan in terms of getting areas that could be of use to be Americans going further away to trade.
Well,
staging posts.
Calling stations. I see what you mean, That's a good point. I hadn't thought about calling stations. But that's a good point.
It definitely mentioned the thing I was reading about. He was keen to get calling stations
sort of
squared away for America.
Yeah.
Calling stations are, we covered it in our previous episodes.
In the Industrial Revolution at Sea episode.
Yeah, exactly. If you haven't listened to that one, it's basically they're just areas where mounds of coal are kept for ships to come and then just shovel it on and keep going.
Yeah,
because if you're steamshipping around coal, you're in quite a lot of trouble.
Yeah. I believe that was footnotesofhistory.com/7.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. Today's episode is footnotesofhistory.com/9.
We're almost into double figures.
I know, it's incredible. It's exciting. I feel like we've covered most stuff. I mean, what happened afterwards?
Or do you want to I think it might be quite interesting to give people an overview of what happened to make it happen.
Okay.
As you've mentioned, Russia's quite keen to get rid of it. They tried in 1859 to open negotiations with America.
They tried to open negotiations with Britain as well.
Yes, they did,
But they weren't.
I think they're kind of, if we can sell it to them, it'll be all right.
Yeah.
But, because at least we'll get something from it.
Yeah.
America was relatively receptive to it.
Yeah.
In 1859 it started, but also I think there was a lot of concern about Southern senators blocking it because they saw this as a unionist power grab.
Yeah, to be honest, I can kind of sympathise.
Yeah, no, yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is all the unionists all over. This is like... classic now imperialist slash nationalist style expansionism of the kind. I'm not saying the Americans are exclusively to blame on this, but of the kind that's happening all over the world at this point, Britain included.
I mean, this is the, you know, also classic scramble for Africa.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of
territory
yeah.
as well. This is, everyone's just trying to find as much as they can.
Yeah, we've that's moved.
That's not been in their idea, civilized.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they're right, it's not right.
Yeah, exactly. We've moved from the 1860s, you know, we've moved from the, what we covered in the Copland Chevalier Treaty, kind of some golden era of free trade. And everyone's got a little bit carried away. It's like, oh, yeah, well.
They literally gone mad for power.
Yeah, it's like this sort of free trade at the end of a sort of barrel of a gun type thing. But, yeah.
No, it's right. And I think, as we've covered, 1859, the plans stalled because the Civil War was on the horizon.
Yeah.
They were concerned about the South's reaction to it. And so plans were shelved throughout the war as well because, you know, you're fighting to basically save America. There's no need to, you can't really start looking to expand it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think... In Washington it's interesting, actually. You say it was fighting to save America, but and I think, actually, there's a fun point for you as well. So the Civil War is actually misnamed because Civil War sort of implies that there are various sides trying to take control of the government.
Mm.
But actually, it wasn't that, because the Southern states just wanted to secede, didn't they, from the government?
A good bit of alliteration. Could call it the Southern Secession War.
And maybe we should just call it that for now.
Just to confuse.
Nobody knows what's going on. Yeah, okay. Yeah, sorry, Karen. Yeah. My rant is over.
For now.
And so, yeah. But yeah, you're right. So it's sort of, I imagine that probably, I mean, that's what I mean about this sort of it being it almost a follow on from the Civil War.
Yeah, it was.
Like, you know what, I'm just going to get this bit as well.
I think it basically was. And I think when the Civil War ended, the Russians thought this is our time to strike. And so the ambassador of that time was sent back with orders to get at least $5 million for the province.
And oh, so, wow, you did well then.
Yeah, he did. He did very well. So he's called Edouard de Stockel. And he was quite well known in Washington, well liked. He'd married an American. But he was also very keen to leave and get posted somewhere else. So he saw this as his ticket to basically, if he could negotiate this, he could get out of America and go somewhere in Europe.
Which I was going to say, not Alaska, sure. Yeah.
He could then be governor of Alaska.
Yeah, exactly. The worst
he just
thing
loved
ever.
Alaska. But no, he wanted to go somewhere in Europe because he saw that as a higher posting at that time.
The icebox. Oh, sorry, I can't, sorry.
Yeah, and so he kind of played on Seward's desire to get Alaska.
Yeah.
And so Seward offered $6 million.
Yeah.
Seward offers $5.5 million.
Yeah.
And then the Russian ambassador stayed quiet for a while. Seward came back with an improved offer, which then rose to about $7.2
million. Yeah, yeah.
So he did very well from that. One of the person I think is really...
As in the ambassador?
The ambassador did quite well in terms of negotiating it up from five.
Well, just by doing nothing.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Another fun, interesting fact that I know about Russia in this period is that doing nothing is like official policy. For example, when you have, they're very, because you've got to remember, Russia is like a multinational empire at this point. Like, it covers all like Kazakhstan, you know, all the modern day Stans are on the border, you know, Georgia and all those areas. And in order to keep it all together, they didn't do anything. They just sort of let them get on with it. So it's quite a strange, but it's obviously worked. But yeah, there's an amusing sort of Russian activity going on here as well. Good.
Through Russian activity, they won again, basically.
They got
the money. But they got the agreement. And then Seward, who at this point had basically just kept quiet to everybody else that he was doing this, apart from the president and the cabinet, then decided it was time to tell Congress.
Absolutely.
He promised this money away. And it's specifically Senator Charles Sumner, who is chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Right.
He's a bit of a legend in terms of at that time. Been around in American politics for years.
Right,
he'd been beaten up by another senator in the lead up to the Civil War.
Oh, wow.
Because he made a vitriolic speech against slavery.
Yeah.
And then the senator grabbed a stick and basically confronted him later on and beat him in the Senate.
Interesting.
And
supposed to be what the Senate's all about. Is it? You're not supposed to solve disputes by beating each other up.
The guy wanted to have a duel, but then he was told by one of his friends that you only duel with your equal, and that that Sumner's basically a drunk, or he's a ne'er-do-well, so he beat him with a stick instead.
Okay.
Seemed
plausible.
Yeah. So Sumner was quite angry that he'd not been consulted, and even though he was quite expansionist, he was sceptical of the deal.
Yeah.
But I think it's quite one of my sort of.
Is he a Republican?
He was a Republican. He was part of the Republican.
Yeah,
he was. He then went away. He got Seward to basically route the bill that was needed to get the treaty done through his committee for consideration.
Right,
and
Seward,
I think, was probably thinking a bit concerned that this was happening. Then he went away and researched Alaska. He went to the Library of Congress and the Smithsonian Institute that just been founded. He read over 100 books and different sources on the subject.
Yeah.
And he was looking at, in English, French, German, and Russian, so he's quite an amazing scholar as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And sort of immersed himself in the subject, saying he was living with seals, walruses, and black foxes at this time. And then he went away and he basically could be converted after he looked at all the evidence. So it's basically the type of politician you want, but you seem to very rarely get at
I
the
suppose
moment.
So, yeah.
And then he became sort of the leading person to get it through the Senate and Congress.
Yeah.
He took into one of the debates one page of notes and spoke for 3 hours on the subject.
Oh, wow.
And later they published a speech that came to 225 pages.
Jesus.
And so he was basically the reason it got through, almost single-handedly pushed it through, and it passed very well.
Yeah.
In the end, 37-2 votes, so there was no danger of being voted down in the Senate.
That seems like quite a very small number of senators.
Well, I think we partially had to think that a lot of the states...
This is all of the Reconstruction period, isn't
it? Yeah, probably haven't really got states
in America.
Like
so
West,
in a way,
the
southern
states
didn't even get a say.
Well, and I think they might have done, I think the West were still
okay.
not fully getting statehood at this point, because it was still kind of like the frontier.
Yeah.
And then they expanded.
Yeah.
And of course, you've got the bits like Hawaii and also Alaska that haven't sent there too yet.
Yeah,
he was also, at the end of his speech, declared that it should be named Alaska.
Yeah.
The territory, rather than something else. He said it should be named from there.
When the Russians called it Alaska?
Russian America, I thought.
I didn't think they called it Russian America.
Oh, I thought it was Russian.
I think they called it Alskaya or something like that. So
I don't know. Similar, but yeah, he was very
adamant. It was sort of barbarization of the local.
Yeah.
Local.
Okay. Well, I think that's where it came from. He said it should be from the local town that it comes from. And that's where he ended it on. It passed. They got the money over to them.
Yeah.
Some of it went missing in bribes.
But
they got the money to Russia.
Yeah.
And then the handover happened between US troops and Russian troops.
Yeah.
Last thing I want to mention before we go on to what people thought of it was quite ironically, I think, for Russia, as they were running the flag down the flagpole, it got stuck.
Yeah.
And three different soldiers had to try and climb the flagpole to disentangle the flag that kept sliding down. So kind of sums up Russia's.
I think, didn't it fall down on someone's bayonets as well?
I think
I read that.
It's like a disaster.
This is literally
just
to underline
our contribution to the
day. And then I think later on as well, like the Russians who were living there basically got chased in by Americans.
Yeah, I didn't know they got chased out. I know they all left, but it kind of makes sense that they were chased out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, it was a sort of, some implicit chasing out. It's like, we're not going to fly these
food. Oh, right, yeah.
It's
like, can stay. But you're probably dying.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's the sale of the actual piece of a continent. But
it came to 2 cents an acre, I think.
Yeah, 2 cents an acre. Which I don't know if you also saw, but basically Siberia, like a piece of land in Siberia, would be 1,000, like over 1,000 times this cost.
Really?
Which is why I'm still in two minds as to whether basically the Russians or the Americans got a good deal. I think the Americans obviously definitely got a good deal. They could afford it, and they did it. I'm not saying it was probably not the right thing to do. I think they were in, as usual in these situations, the government is thinking a sort of feudal mindset where more land is better. Just generally.
I think at the time both sides could be happy with
what
they got.
Absolutely.
I think we can say that Russia got a bad deal now, but at the time, as we covered, there was no real way that they would have been able to make a success because they didn't have the infrastructure or capacity.
Yeah, and there is also the danger that if they'd gone for even higher price, America might not have been bothered, and they'd been stuck with this piece of
literally albatross,
an ice box.
Well, literally albatross, but
literally a polar bear on the road.
Yeah, which is quite an interesting thing to round off, and I think people's views on it. I think you've touched on it there.
Yeah,
about sort of some of the names it was called by various elements of the press throughout the sort of negotiations. Do you want to give a few more? Because they're quite funny.
We don't need we don't need an ice box.
Yeah.
We don't need a polar bear garden. Populated by ex-Eskimos who live on fish oil or something along those lines.
Just generally quite horrific thoughts on it. There was also Seward's Folly. The New York World said that Russia sold us a sucked orange. Quite interesting.
Yeah. I think that pretty much, at the time, that probably summed it up.
Yeah,
it?
Yeah.
As we discussed, it's only basically a combination of technology, industrialization, and actual property rights of the people who were farming the seals that actually made it profitable in that respect.
Yeah. I think also like drawing people to it as well. So I think there's the Klondike Gold Rush as well.
Oh yeah, of course.
Which
drew
many people up there.
Yeah, but that was more of a coincidence.
It was a coincidence,
but
I think Russia never really had the draw to get people there to do stuff with the territory, whereas that helped basically bring Well, there were thousands of people descending onto it, and I think it had a knock-on effect. In that, although, you know, they went there, then those people left. But I think getting people there in the first place was quite a psychologically was quite a good thing.
Yeah.
Territory.
Do you want to talk about the Klondike Gold Rush briefly, or?
I think that's a topic for another episode.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I think there's a lot in there.
Basically, the Klondike area is basically right on the border between what is now modern Alaska and modern Canada. So people were flooding in from the British Columbia, the Canadian side, essentially, now. But then, obviously, Americans were sort of like, sort of had to go around.
And it's an amazing story. They had to literally climb over mountains, build... Yeah. rafts, and then just not even like buy them, build them themselves, and then sell them through rapids just to get there. So I think it's definitely episode. I think we should come on to another episode because it's just so
much stuff going on.
But one thing I wanted to mention in regards to the Americans who didn't like Alaska being bought was one of the senators who I imagine voted against the idea.
Go on. What gave that impression?
Well, his name was William Pitt Fessenden. I think he was named after another famous politician.
Another famous
And he, during the debate, he said he'd only vote for the treaty if Seward would be compelled to live there.
That's amazing. That's hilarious.
Which I think is quite amusing.
It's a horrific fate to befall anyone. I've never been to Alaska, but at the time, the descriptions that I've read seem to be a bit sort of like...
Well, fun fact for you, after Seward left office, he actually went there to make a speech and to visit and see what was there. So, I mean, he clearly... Maybe not living there, but he at least visited.
He at least went there.
But I think also it works two ways. There's also quite a lot of hyperbole on the other side. So you have things like the Charlestown Daily Herald on its front page when the treaty came through. It was basically lauding this great acquisition, saying that the territory contained the highest mountain in the world from which the American eagle could sit atop and then spread its wings over the territory. Yeah. And that basically America would be sitting pretty on this territory whilst... Europe degenerated into asking various questions about who owned what on the old continent.
Yeah.
So I think it works both ways, that people were kind of either vitriolically opposed to it or vitriolically in favour of it, and then just a load of people in the middle who just didn't care.
I wonder whether, as well as we mentioned, potentially the Civil War might have also coloured people's opinions on the issue as well. Mm-hmm. Like, obviously it's all a bit...
Yeah.
It's quite difficult to see without further in-depth research to know exactly what... Who particularly was saying what. But if you're of the opinion that the government isn't, it's just this bunch of arrogant sort of expansionists, then potentially you'd probably be against this as well.
Yeah. Do you want to hear two sort of comments from famous Germans before we head into further reading?
Of course.
Just sort of round it off quite nicely.
Famous Germans.
Two which I feel people wouldn't really think of agreeing too much. Yeah. So
can I just kind of say there is a fun point to make here. A fun point.
It's all fun.
Oh, it's a history, exactly. So we're talking about nationalist and imperialist sentiment. At this point, for context, in Europe, essentially Germany is sort of almost there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a nation, it comes to fruition in 1870, 1871.
Yeah.
And the same with Italy as well. It comes to full fruition. I mean, sort of basically there in 1866.
Yeah.
But, this is a time when...
The modern nation, world coming together.
Yeah, but the sort of the concept of a modern nation and that I feel that the slight hubris that comes with governing a nation is starting to come to full fruition, especially, and we're seeing this in this sort of North American venture. Carry on, sorry.
No, so I've two Germans who kind of relatively agree with each other in this point, but I feel not much else. So one you've already alluded to his work, which is Otto von Bismarck.
Of course.
So he was the first Chancellor?
Chancellor of Prussia.
He was one of the architects behind bringing Germany to Germany.
He claimed to have almost single-handedly created Germany, but I think he was quite lucky.
Yeah, I think
he was also quite sneaky.
Right man, right place, I think.
And he also had the army. So,
always helps when you want to build a nation.
Yeah.
But his view was that Russia had squandered the territory and the US would make a lot better use of it and they'd find a better use for it.
Well, that's fair.
I think it's definitely a clear sight analysis of the problem.
Although I'm not sure whether, obviously America did do something with it, but it didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the second one is Karl Marx. Felt that from the economic side, the acquisition is not worth a cent at present.
Yeah.
But the Yankees will come, cut England off from the sea from one side and hasten the annexation of all British North America and the United States.
Yeah.
So I feel He's on something to begin with, but then he degenerates a little bit.
Yeah.
Because he was right in something, economic side, at the present, not where the set. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but I mean, to who? Do you know what I mean? Like, as we discussed earlier, the value to America and to Russia was completely different.
Mm-hmm.
The subjective value, which Marx doesn't understand.
Okay.
Sorry.
Fair enough, then. I'm not going to defend it, but I think he was on something with what he'd seen with Russia.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically, as Bismarck said, squandering the problems.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think he was definitely, shall we say, little off piece with his secondary.
It's an interesting. I mean, so he was saying it would separate the separate the British from the Pacific.
He has quite a limited grasp of geography, I think, because he's cutting them off from the sea on one side, which he didn't.
Yeah. Well, I suppose what they would refer, presumably they were referring to British Columbia / Canada.
Yeah, but British Columbia has had a coast.
Yeah, I guess so. I suppose that is. Yeah, that's a fair point.
And just one.
So, was he talking about somewhere completely different?
He was just drunk. Arctic,
yeah, yeah.
He had no idea what he was talking about.
Yeah.
So, as we've mentioned,
no Alaska. Surprises, that.
why separate from the habit of a lifetime, I suppose. So Alaska Treaty was signed in 1867.
Yeah.
It was then basically ruled by one of some military government, wasn't it? Until 1884, when civil government came in.
Yeah.
And then in 1959. Had to work quite a while to achieve full statehood.
Oh, wow.
So that was kind of the fate of Alaska.
Nearly over a century later.
Yeah.
To be fair, though, there's no one there. So. Well, I mean,
Tim.
Nobody. I mean, this is another slightly bizarre situation where Russia doesn't. I mean, there are almost no Russians there.
Yeah.
All the people who live there are Eskimos or Aleuts.
Yeah.
And they are now the property of America.
Mm.
So what is that all about?
Yeah, it is worth mentioning they had the people who actually lived there in the first place, the indigenous population, had no say in this sale at all, which is, you know, it's indicative of the times, really, isn't it?
As we said.
Before we do any conclusions, I think I have one, if anyone wants to find out anything more about the Alaska Purchase, there's one very good thing that I found in the US National Archives website called...
The Office of the Historian.
It's a different one.
It's a different
one.
Okay.
That one
actually slightly annoyed me because it doesn't go into any detail at all.
But this one goes into lots of detail. Okay. It even tells you about how much people were bribed.
Yeah. Also, can I just ask, when was the Office for the Historian archived? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. Carry on, sorry.
So in the US National Archives, there's a page called Seward's Design, the Alaska Purchase, I just couldn't be
my own. Alaska Purchase. Okay.
So, in the US National Archives, there's a good page called Seward's Design, the Alaska Purchase from Russia, not Romania. from Russia. And it goes into a lot of detail, tells you all the main players, what they thought about it, and what happened. So I think if anyone wanting to read more on the subject, that's your first point to
get. I would say so, yeah. I mean, I think it's quite helpful, even if you don't end up believing them in the end, the official documentation of the events is quite useful for the framework of what the things were going on.
Definitely.
Sort of,
do you have any sort of conclusions you want to draw from this?
Not hugely. I just think it's quite a nice little. I mean, it's quite a nice little topic for an episode.
It's
very specific.
Yeah. It's confined into quite specific. Like, there's no there's an end point.
Yeah, exactly.
And the beginning as well.
But also, you know, sort of on the sort of flip side of that, you get to talk about a lot of other things that are also happening, which are influencing this thing happening, which is. I think it's a classic film of history.
Yeah, it is. I think from my perspective, it's also quite interesting. I hope that people find it interesting to go into it further, looking at America's sort of expansionist.
Yeah, imperialism.
And also just being able to show that how, in some ways, more advanced America was than Russia at that point.
Yeah.
Showing that the economy is completely different.
Yeah.
And Russia has such a long way to go to actually make something out of this territory.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, let's fade the music in. That's the end of the episode.
Thanks for listening to Footnotes of History. For more episodes, visit footnotesofhistory.com and subscribe. Or, if you want to suggest an episode to us, email us on episodes@footnotesofhistory.com. You can also follow us on social media at FOH Podcast for Twitter, and we're also on Instagram and YouTube. Thanks for listening.